Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We have an empowerment hour lined up. First and always, the latest on health and healing. Music lessons early in life increase brain development. Vitamin C helps marathon runners reduce risk of catching a cold. And a separate study shows that vitamin C can lower your blood pressure. High levels of attachment anxiety lower your immunity and increase your vulnerability to illness. And lots more. Our guest today will be A Conversation with Remarkable Minds. This is one of the most popular series I do because I bring together some of the finest minds on the planet to give you insights into the human condition. Today, understanding the nature of our collective psychoses and violence that permeates Western societies and now is globalizing the planet. Paul Levy, who's a pioneer in postmodern psycho-spiritual movements, he has a strong academic background from Princeton, and he also, for years, has studied with accomplished Tibetan and Burmese Buddhist teachers, and he's been a serious student of Native American and world mythology. We'll also today look at a couple commentaries, one from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. It has happened here in America. The police state is real. This is a part of our continuing series on fascism in America. But also today, Bill Moyers, in a discussion with Matt Tabibi, on how we have a system where those who are powerful break the law with impunity. And you will hear about the laws they break. At the same time, if you miss a traffic ticket, you can go to jail. The return of debtors' prisons and hard times in the USA. I'll be juxtapositioning the two different dynamics. And also, we've gone so crazy with this paranoia that everyone is a potential terrorist that a five-year-old girl suspended from school accused of being a terrorist for talking about playing with her Hello Kitty bubblegum. This is what's going on in the world today, and we're going to bring it to you. First up, always with health and healing. Playing the recorder in kindergarten, piano lessons in first grade, clapping to the rhythm throughout the elementary school music class, all of these can contribute to developing the brain. That's according to Medical News Today. Now, it's published in the peer-reviewed journal, Journal of Neuroscience, and it reveals that musical training earlier than the age of 7 has a significant impact on the development of the brain. Those who began musical training early had more powerful connections between motor regions. That's the part of the brain that aids in planning and executing movements. The study was conducted in a laboratory at Concordia University. The findings, quote, reveal significant evidence that the years between the ages of 6 and 8 are an extra sensitive time when musical training combines with normal brain development to create deep-rooted changes in motor abilities and brain structure. So, the suggestion there is get your kid into music earlier. The earlier, the better. Now, being a marathoner, having done well over 50 marathons, one of the joys of my life was being in the first waterfront marathon, Jersey Shore Marathon, San Francisco, Los Angeles Marathon, Montreal, and Marine Corps Marathon, London Marathon. Around the world, I like to travel with our running and walking group and do these marathons. It's a wonderful thing. And if you've never done a marathon, I suggest you try. But, of course, the problem is when you're training for a marathon, you're really stressing your immune system. In fact, I was curious to see why the runners and walkers in our club were not coming down with the same injuries as those in the other clubs, as I have friends who are in many of the other clubs. And it's because we graduate our training. We literally peak the week of the marathon. So in the middle of July, you'll see people doing 18-mile days. We're doing 10-mile days. So we build also gradually. Also, we take lots of supplements and juice, and almost everyone's a vegan in the club. And we've trained over 26,000 people to do these races in the marathon. So we have a good group of people to work with, good feedback. And everywhere you look, in the middle of summer, people are saying they have aches and pains and colds and flu-like symptoms because the training really wreaks havoc on your immune system unless you compensate. So we made sure that each person got about 15,000 milligrams of vitamin C on their long workout days to compensate for the amount of free radicals you produce when you train hard. Here's the latest on this. This is an article from the Cochrane Library, which is a major scientific review. A placebo-controlled trial on vitamin C and the common cold finds that vitamin C may be helping people under heavy physical stress, such as marathoners and skiers, to reduce their risk of catching a cold. As for the rest of the population, the review finds no evidence that regular supplement of vitamin C reduces the chance of coming down with a common cold, although it will reduce the duration and severity of the illness. Now, I would challenge them on that, because, yes, there are over 200 viruses that can cause common cold symptoms, like runny nose and sneezing and sore throat and congestion and cough and red eyes and fever. But, and here is the difference, when you take small amounts of vitamin C, let's say less than a gram per day, and that's what they were using. And they found that, yes, 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day reduces cold symptoms by 18%. Well, that's good. But you know that when you're coming down with a cold, you have to go up to bowel tolerance. Now, bowel tolerance may be 20 or 30,000 milligrams. Not under 1,000 milligrams. And it should be in divided doses, not in one single dose. Well, they were taking it in one dose. So here is the lesson takeaway from this. If you take between 5 and 15,000 milligrams a day, or up to bowel tolerance, meaning when you start getting upset stomach or diarrhea, then back it down again. And if you take it in buffered form, not just straight ascorbic acid. And if you also then have one more barrier by taking it in a protein shake, making a big protein shake in the morning, and then taking small amounts of that protein shake throughout the day, A, you're going to keep your blood sugar stable. B, you're going to provide sustainable energy all day. None of those ups and downs and fatigue and looking at the clock at 4 o'clock thinking, wow, I'm so tired, I'd like to take a nap. You're going to be sustained. But also you're putting vitamin C into the body in a buffered form, buffered again with the protein, higher utilization. And then you could probably be averaging 10,000 milligrams a day. Now what's good is, right across the board, people will say, gee whiz, I just went through the last 2 years with no colds or flu. And if I started to feel tired or weak because of what I was doing and I took extra and rested more, I didn't come down with anything. I get feedback from school teachers who are notoriously susceptible to catching what's in the classroom. And when they start this kind of protocol of, in effect, cold and flu-proofing their body, how do you do that? First, you wash your hands. Then you spray the air in between classes with air therapy that traps and kills bacteria and viruses that are in the air. Third, just take some isopropyl alcohol and wipe down the desks in between classes. Then take some green tea in the morning with Manuka honey and spike it with Echinacea, Astragalus, Paldiarco, Vitamin C, Quercetin, all of which are antiviral and several are antibacterial as well. And then you take that in a thermos, either cold or hot, and you drink that throughout the day. Then you spray your mouth and nose every 2 hours, just a little spritz with colloidal silver spray, 200 to 500 parts per million. that will disinfect and kill all bacteria and viruses that come upon you from students talking right in your face. And this is one of the reasons I can be in a crowd for hours, not just lecturing, but one-on-one with people and never get sick, because I simply take some simple steps that can prevent that. And then, of course, you can wear a simple ionizer underneath around your neck, and no one even knows it's there. You should always wear it on airplanes, going to movie theater, where there are congestions of people, on subways. Again, it's the size of a small battery, but it's creating a protective barrier around your head by about a foot. Simple things, and you reduce the cold. Now, one more thing about vitamin C. Another study that was a good study showed that vitamin C lowered blood pressure. And remember, humans don't synthesize vitamin C from glucose in times of stress. And other animals do. Johns Hopkins University found that those people who take at least 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day had lower blood pressure than those that did not. So I'm suggesting take a lot more than that, and you should lower your blood pressure substantially. And another thing, we all know that anxiety is a major stressor. And when you're stressed, a whole series of hormones are elevated in the body. There are more than 3,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on psychoneuroimmunology. Break it down. Psycho, your thoughts. Neuro, your neurological system. Immuno, your immune system, meaning what you think impacts your brain chemistry, and your immunity. It's all interconnected. So happy thoughts keep you healthy. Angry, sad, depressed, anxious thoughts can make you vulnerable to illness. This is the latest on this from Ohio State University. They talked about concerns and anxieties about one's close relationships, and it appears to function as a chronic stressor that can compromise immunity. Here's what they say. Quote, researchers ask married couples to complete questionnaires about their relationships, and then they collected a blood sample, saliva, to test participants' levels of a key stress-related hormone and the number of certain immune cells in the body. The researchers focused on attachment anxiety. Those who are on the high end of the attachment anxiety spectrum are excessively concerned about being rejected, have a tendency to constantly seek reassurance that they are loved, and are more likely to interpret ambiguous events in a relationship as negative. And married partners who were more anxiously attached produced higher levels of cortisol, and we all know that cortisol is a steroid hormone. It's released in response to stress, and you're going to have fewer T cells, and that is bad because those T cells are important components of the immune system's defense against infection than did participants who were less anxious. Quote, everyone has these types of concerns now and again in their relationships. But a high level of attachment anxiety refers to people who have those worries fairly constantly in most of their relationships. So, just be aware that if you're afraid of losing someone in a relationship, you're already losing your health. And that's one of the reasons that I counsel people that de-stressing is the number one step to living a longer life. When I've traveled throughout the world, as I do, and I spend quality time speaking with people, I find those who live in the cities anywhere in the world are more stressed than those who live in the rural areas. And frequently, those who live in the suburbs are even more stressed still. They don't always have the immediate access to culture and the benefits, but they have all the expenses and the maintenance and the problems that come with it. But when you live in the rural areas, the more bucolic areas, people are just a whole lot less stressed. Let me just give you an example. I was in France visiting a friend who was very ill. So I flew over to try to help get him back his health. And he hadn't been to his home in France in 5 years. And beside his beautiful home, there was a bunch of weeds. In fact, there was weeds everywhere. And I was out walking, and I came across some rocks. And it piqued my curiosity. And I started pulling out some roots, and I found that this was all hand-laid stone. And so I get a shovel, and I start digging, and then I realize that this thing is a wall. A wall to what? And then in comes a backhoe a day later, and a local farmer digs out this, and it turns out that this was a 12th century water hole or pool of some kind. It was big. It was like the size of a community pool, but much deeper, all in this natural stone. And then this led to a natural spring that filled this. On one end it filled it, on the other end it have an overflow with a hole that let out. And when this was all done, which took about a week and a half, and you had this crystal clean water, pure water, spring water, you could drink it right out, and I did. And I went swimming. It was a little cold, but it was the summertime, but it was so refreshing. And I just would go down and just swim and look around. And it was just amazing to think that someone was using this water in the 12th century. So I had my friend come down, and he was convalescing, and I just had him sit there each day and watch the water flowing in and flowing out. And it flew out down, opened up the back, and cleaned up shrubs and overgrowth across some beautiful rocks, and just sitting by rocks as water was flowing over it, within 2 or 3 days, he says, Gary, he says, I'm feeling really much better. I said, why? He said, I've been thinking about my problems, and I know that thinking about all my problems has caused a lot of stress, and this is when I get the shingles, and this is when I get, you know, this stomach and abdominal cramps, and this is when all the pain comes. He says, I haven't had any problems, and my shingles is no longer in an outbreak form. So I got some honey from a local farmer, raw, unheated honey right out of the hive. I'm a beekeeper. I've been a beekeeper and a certified organic farmer my whole adult life. I have 40 beehives now, in fact. And I showed him how to take out a little honey, and I made a salve from this, blending in a little bee propolis, and then massaged it over the back. And he had, if you've ever seen anyone with shingles, it's really painful, and it's like blisters, and they ooze, and it takes a long time to heal, and massaged all that. But then I took a bandage, and I said to my friend, I said, the water that is going to be soaking this, because I wanted to keep it wet, is coming from an aquifer that's millions of years old. And it's as pure now as it was when it was formed. And you're going to be having nature help you in your healing. The bees, the propolis, and the mineral water. So that's what he did. And I mean, it was so quick that he healed. And then I said, okay. I was there about a week and a half. I said, I got to go back. I said, but you're on your feet now. What lesson have you learned? And driving me to the airport, he said, well, he said, a lesson that I didn't want to learn. I spent my whole life, this is what he said to me, he said, I spent my whole life making myself necessary to everyone else and supporting them in their crisis. But I never took care of my own life. And as a result, I guess it was coming from my own insecurity. And as a result of that, I'm lonely. I possess too many things. I've made what I own more important than who I am. And all that's going to change. Because I can't remember when I was so much at peace and in joy as just sitting, watching water flow over some rocks. He said, wow. He said, is that a simple lesson to learn? And I said to my friend, well, you realize there have been people doing this all over the world in every culture, from Native Americans to Asians to those living in the Himalayas. They just blend themselves and harmonize with nature. And within 3 weeks, he had started downsizing, and within about 3 months, he had eliminated almost everything in his life that he had worked his whole life. And I was younger, and he was older. Most of my friends at that time were older. And he got rid of everything, and then he started to have abundance of joy. And that's the takeaway of that story. So if you become anxious over what you possess, whether it's an object, a home, or a person, you already have lost the ability to harmonize in peace and joy with it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go in just a moment here to Bill Moyer's interview with Matt Tabibi. It's a part of our continuing series, A Piece at a Time, on fascism in America. Fascism, where government powers joined together with corporate powers to create an almost an oligarchical and very lopsided power structure. Before we go there, however, this is from Alex Kane of Alternet. Miss a traffic ticket, go to jail. The return of debtor's prison. I'm reading this because it segues into the Bill Moyers piece. Editor's note, America has a long history of treating the poor like criminals. From legislation banning the transportation of poor people across state lines to anti-vagrancy laws that could land you in jail if you don't have a job or a home. We've come to rely on the criminal justice system to deal with the poor, even as more and more Americans fall into poverty. Kawana Young, a single mother of two, was arrested in Michigan after failing to pay money she owed as a result of a minor traffic offense. She was recently laid off from her job and could not pay the fees she owed because she could not find another source of employment. So a judge sentenced her to 3 days in jail. In addition, Ms. Young was charged additional fees for being booked and for the room and food in jail. In total, she had been jailed 5 times, all because she couldn't pay any of her debts. Quote, it doesn't make sense to jail people when they can't pay because they definitely can't pay while they're in jail, she said. Debtor prisons seem to belong in America's past. But if you think the existence of prisons for people who can't afford to pay their debts is in the past, think again. Mrs. Young's ordeal, profiled in the American Civil Liberties Union report, was when she was given a ticket driving without a license. Now, Mrs. Young was arrested when she did not pay off all of her debts from traffic violations. That arrest led the judge ordering her to jail due to her inability to pay the money. Prison time for poor people in debt remains something that is practiced throughout the United States. Despite the fact that a 1983 Supreme Court decision ruled that a prisoner on probation who could not afford to pay his debts could not be thrown in jail. For that reason, the practice of imprisoning people for debt is being fueled by the economic crash that has decimated state and city budgets. Debtor prisons are also on the rise thanks to the zeal of private companies that file lawsuits against debtors and often fail to serve them with notice of court dates or intentionally serve them at incorrect addresses. As the Brennan Center for Justice showed, quote, when debtors do not show up, agencies procure arrest warrants from courts leading to incarceration for the debtors. Bail is usually set at an amount equal to or higher than the original fees and fines the defendants couldn't pay in the first place. All this has amounted to a return of debtors' prisons. The American Civil Liberties Union lays out the breadth of this problem, entitled In for a Penny, The Rise of America's New Debtor Prisons. The report examines how day after day, indigent defendants are imprisoned for failing to pay legal debts they can never hope to manage. In many cases, poor men and women end up jailed or threatened with jail, though they have no lawyer representing them. The practice of throwing people into jail got in more attention last year due to a New York Times report examining the mushrooming of fines and fees levied by money-starved towns across the country and the for-profit businesses that administer the system, the result being growing numbers of poor people ending up jailed and in debt for minor infractions. Ethan Broner, a reporter for the New York Times, profiled Gina Ray, who was fined $179 for a ticket. She did not show up in court because they put the wrong date on the ticket. As a result, her driver's license was revoked. So she had to work. So the next time she was pulled over, she was arrested. She was given a fine and fees of $1,500. Of course, she couldn't pay it. She was handed over to a private probation company and jailed, and charged additional fees for every day behind bars. So the phenomenon of debtor prison creates a two-tier justice system. For more people unable to pay money they owe from traffic infractions and other debts, jail becomes home for a longer period of time. So that is something I think is important. Now, this is an interview to show you the other side of this coin and the fact that there are proven crimes against humanity of every sort being perpetrated, and not a single person is being found guilty or put in jail or a reputation besmirched or ruined. This is the system that is everywhere, and we have made it an absolutely form of high art.
This week, two United States senators insisted that the Justice Department come clean. Why? Are Wall Street's big banks not only too big to fail, but too big to jail? Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, a Democrat, and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, a Republican, are outraged that the giant banks violate the law with impunity, laundering money, cheating homeowners, falsifying information, every trick in the ledger book. They sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder demanding to know why the banks get away with fines instead of jail time. Maybe they had their anger roiled by Frontline, public television's premier investigative series. The other night, Frontline broadcast a report called The Untouchables on how the Department of Justice allegedly has looked the other way for fear that prosecuting the banks would do even more damage to the American economy.
There was a definite sense that justice backed off.
Did the government fail?
A number of people told us that you didn't make this a top priority.
Well, I'm sorry if they think that, because I made it an incredibly top priority.
That's Lanny Brewer, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division at the Justice Department. A week after the Frontline report, he stepped down and is now expected to return to private corporate practice, one more government appointee spinning through the lucrative revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. That door could be a big reason why government treats the banks with kid gloves. A man who once worked for Citigroup, Jack Lew, the president's chief of staff, has been picked to be the new Treasury Secretary. And Mary Jo White, the newly named head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, is a chief litigator at a top law firm representing big investment banks like Morgan Stanley. With all this happening, it's time to talk with journalist Matt Taibbi. You've seen him on our broadcast before. A contributing editor at Rolling Stone, He's been tracking the high crimes and misdemeanors of Wall Street and Washington for years. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're working on a story right now to come out in a couple of weeks on the HSBC settlement. That's
right.
Tell me about that, why it interests you.
Well, the HSBC settlement was a really shocking kind of new low in the history of the too big to fail issue. HSBC was a serial offender on the money laundering score. They had been twice given formal cease and desist orders by the government, one dating back as far as 2003, another one in 2010, for inadequately policing the accounts in their system. They laundered over $800 million for cartels in Colombia. Drug cartels in Colombia and Mexico. They laundered money for terrorist-connected banks in the Middle East, Russian gangsters. Literally, you know, I talked to one prosecutor. It's like they broke basically every law in the book, and they did business with every kind of criminal you can possibly imagine. And they got a complete and total walk. I mean, they had to pay a fine.
$1.9 billion, a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but it's 5 weeks of revenue for the bank, to put that in perspective, and no individual had to suffer any consequences at all. There were no criminal charges, no individual fines, which was incredible, incredible.
Lanny Breuer also forced the Swiss bank UBS, as you know, to pay a big fine in the LIBOR, the price-fixing conspiracy, and that outraged you as well, didn't it?
This is the biggest financial scandal of all time. It was a price-fixing scandal where essentially some of the world's biggest banks got together and they conspired illegally to artificially rig the global interest rates, which are based upon this London Interbank Offered Rate, which is a rate that measures how much it costs for banks to lend money to each other. This LIBOR rate affects the prices of hundreds of trillions of dollars of financial products, and it goes from everything from credit cards to mortgages to municipal bonds. Basically, everything in the world, the price is somehow connected to LIBOR. And these guys were monkeying around with this for individual profit. And they got, again, a complete and total walk on this. There were no criminal charges, which is just unbelievable.
Did you see the Frontline documentary, The Untouchables?
I did.
Then you're familiar with Lanny Breuer's testimony.
You made a reference to losing sleep at night, worrying about what a lawsuit might result in at a large financial
Right.
institution. Is that really the job of a prosecutor to worry about anything other than simply pursuing justice?
Well, I think I am pursuing justice, and I think the entire responsibility of the department is to pursue justice. But in any given case, I think I and prosecutors around the country being responsible should speak to regulators, should speak to experts. Because if I bring a case against Institution A, and as a result of bringing that case, there's some huge economic effect. If it creates a ripple effect so that suddenly counterparties and other financial institutions or other companies that had nothing to do with this are affected badly, it's a factor we need to know and understand.
Think about what he's saying. He's essentially saying that some individuals are so systemically important that they can't be arrested and put in jail. Now, it's only a few steps forward to the corollary to that, which is if some people are too systemically important to arrest, other people may safely be arrested. So we're creating a class of people who are arrestable and another class of people who are not arrestable, which is crazy. It's a crazy thing for the Assistant Attorney General to say, to admit out loud that he's dividing Americans up into these two classes. There's no reason they couldn't have taken a number of individuals from some of these companies and put them on trial. Historically, we've always done this, even under the Bush administration. If you go back just 10 years, WorldCom, Enron, Adelphia, we took the leading individuals at these companies and we put them on trial to make an example out of them. And this is exactly what we're not doing in this case. Those companies were systemically important then. I don't see why they can't do the same thing now.
You were shocked when you heard that President Obama had named Mary Jo White to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission. You wrote that she was a partner in a law firm that represented a lot of these big banks, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Chase, AIG, Morgan Stanley. You said she dropped out and made the move a lot of regulators make, leaving government to make bucket loads of money working for the people she used to police. And I gather your great concern is that you don't want to see the country's top financial cop being indebted to the people who created the bankroll.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just simple common sense. I mean, if you're sitting on $10 million, $15 million, however much money she made working there at Debra Woz and Plimpton when she was a partner, and you owe that money to this specific group of clients, and now you're in charge of policing them, just psychologically think about it. It doesn't really work. You know, it doesn't really work in terms of how aggressive a prosecutor should be, what his attitude towards, the people he's supposed to be policing should be. It's just the circumstances just aren't quite right. You'd much rather see a career civil servant in that situation.
She was once a tough prosecutor. What's your beef?
Well, I have people who are telling me that I'm wrong about this, that Mary Jo White was an excellent prosecutor and she's a good choice. But, I've done stories in the past about an episode. You had an SEC investigator named Gary Aguirre who was pursuing an insider trading case against the future CEO of Morgan Stanley. He asked for permission to interview that future CEO. His name was John Mack. It was denied, and it was because there was communication between Morgan Stanley's lawyer, who at the time was Mary Jo White, and the higher-ups at the SEC, who included the director of enforcement, Linda Thompson. Aguirre was later fired for complaining about having this investigation squelched.
Blowing the whistle.
For blowing the whistle, but the SEC was later forced to pay a $750,000 wrongful termination suit to Aguirre. In that case. But what's so interesting is that Aguirre's boss, the guy who killed that case, went to work for Mary Jo White's firm 9 months after the case died, and he got, a multi-million-dollar position. It's a classic example of how the revolving door works in Washington. You know, you have these regulators at the SEC, and they know that there's that job out there waiting for them. So how hard are they really going to regulate these companies when they know they can get that money? But in Washington, people kind of shake their heads at it because it's so common, that these people, they move from government back to, these high-priced legal defense firms that represent the banks, and then they go back to government again. And it's just sort of this coterie of 100, 200 lawyers who really run this entire thing, and it's all the same people on both sides.
Lanny Brewer was one of them. He was in a very prestigious Washington law firm. Jack Lew, the incoming Secretary of the Treasury, if he gets approved, served 3 years at Citi Group. His record there, according to the Wall Street Journal, was...
Well, what you've been listening to is just one piece of a massive puzzle to show you that our entire political system is manipulated and controlled by a relatively small number of individuals who are self-serving. Many are lawyers. And they do not represent our interest. But a person who does is on the phone now. Paul Levy. I mentioned his background earlier. He is a pioneer in postmodern psycho-spiritual movements. And he is an author, including his work is earlier publication, The Madness of George Bush, A Reflection of Our Collective Psychosis. His website is awakenthedream.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Yeah, hi. I'm really happy to be here, Gary. Thank you.
I'd like to begin with an example that Catherine Austin Fitz writes in the foreword of your book, because I believe it gives a picture of a situation many of our listeners will resonate with, given the topics we explore frequently on this program. She shares a story of giving a lecture at a conference to about 100 people who were spiritually oriented financiers and Wall Street types. She asked, if you could push a button that would immediately stop all hard drugs and narco trafficking throughout the country, but also knew it would offend a lot of powerful people who are controlling up to $1 trillion of global money laundering and all the various exotic trades and investments that depend upon that drug trade, would you push the button? Only 1% of the group said they would. The reason the other 99% gave was that they didn't want their mutual funds to be affected, or that if there were a termination to that amount of capital, their various financial securities, investments, and taxes would be compromised because the system they are so used to and depend upon for financial security relies on this illegal money circulating in the system. Now, I am sure many of these people live basically ethical and moral lives and would be considered upright, well-meaning human beings. Nevertheless, they would still sacrifice higher values in order to favor something evil, if that evil actually serves their best interest. And we witness this in just about everything today. Clearly, the entire corporate Democrats with Clinton and Obama, clearly the entire corporate Republicans with Bush and Reagan represent this evil. We witness this in just about everything today, permitting fascist qualities to emerge from our national intelligence agencies and police departments. There was a poll today that 30% of people don't mind TSA officers groping them. There's a growing willingness to sacrifice our freedoms and liberties so that an Orwellian state can protect us from imaginary enemies that the government has fabricated, or to allow the Exxons and the Shells and the Monsantos and the DuPonts and the energy fracking companies and the pharmaceutical industries and the private military contractors and all of Wall Street and all the hedge funds and the major media, News Corp and Time Warner and Walt Disney to basically control and rule our lives. And most Americans appear to be basically just fine with that. So please, address this collective psychological illness that pervades our culture and which has conditioned us to act against our best ethical interests and our higher spiritual values. You have called these psycho-spiritual states. So go into this in depth, if you would, please.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. So I basically point out that when you really go into the origin of the evil that's playing out, both individually and collectively as a species and in our greater body politic, the origin is the psyche. And so basically, just to take a step back, the Native American people have for centuries been tracking this illness, and they call it Watiko, and it's a psycho-spiritual illness of the soul, which means it exists in the collective unconscious of our species, which means that any of us at any moment can fall prey to it. And it's a form of this blindness, of this psychological, like this blindness, which imagines that it's sighted and imagines that it's more sighted than anyone else, and it works through the projective tendencies of our mind. And its origin is the psyche, but it explicates itself through the medium of the outside world, which is to say that what's happening in the greater body politic is a reflection of something that's happening deep inside the psyche of each one of us. And that's the way in, and that's really the fundamental source of what's playing out, all of the evil in the greater body politic of the world. And that's what my new book is about.
Good. Now I want to go a little deeper into this. Outside of fundamentalistic religious groups and extremist politics, for example, George Bush and his minions, why is there so much reluctance in liberal and progressive people, at least those who call themselves progressive, and among people who identify as being spiritual and not religious, to call something evil? We find it okay to call the atrocities of the Nazis or the Chinese Cultural Revolution in Tibet or Stalin's gulags or the Turkish genocide of Armenians or Middle Eastern genocide bombers and suicide bombers, because those are events are either in the past or in a distant land, not in our backyard. But we are afraid to look at events today as evil, such as our drone attacks, virtually all of the National Defense Authorization manifestations, the Patriot Act, and our attacking overseas, or our government permitting the Israeli apartheid of Palestinians in Gaza to continue. And historically, these are recycled actions of the past, except in a different costume and by more modern means that become accepted by many people as benign, especially the Democrats. Damn them for their arrogance and at the same time their utter insensitivity and separation from all that is spiritual. So I want you to address the things.
Right,
sure.
Please. And I think the answer to that is the fact that we're complicit in the evil, and that's, to really take a look at that and to self-reflect and to see, we can't project the shadow out there onto some evil being all the way on the other side of the planet or 100 years ago, but we're actually in collusion with the evil of our government in so many ways that induces a form of PTSD, a form of trauma. So, you know, kind of encoded in the, if you call it a psychic pathology, is this counter incentive to actually, you know, to self-reflect and to see our part in it. And so, it, you know, it actually takes somebody of, you know, real courage to take a look how we're actually complicit in the very darkness that we're reacting against.
Give us examples.
Yeah, well, okay, say, for example, you know, so many people in this country are just, you know, at least consciously have this good conscience thinking, oh, I'm a good, kind, spiritual person. And yet, take a look at what our government is doing in our name. And yet people really sort of have this disassociation between what's being done in their name by their government, by the people they've supposedly elected. And, you know, they don't see the part that they're playing. And they also split off from that unconscious feeling of guilt with reference to their collusion of what's happening. And that, you know, so then they become split in themselves, in their own psyche. They actually become not fully connected with their power. And all of that then feeds, in a way, the evil to play out, or what I'm calling the psychospiritual virus, to actually just act out, running, you know, just, you know, completely wreaking havoc, you know, throughout the whole planet, really.
Okay. I appreciate that insight and the connection of my question to your answer. Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
If you support a person because you like them at a charismatic level, or there's something that appeals to you, how then do you justify in your own mind that what that person does ends up causing massive suffering, death, destruction across the planet, and yet you divorce yourself from any of those actions and still continue to like the person? As the Democrats did with Clinton when he didn't intercede in stopping the genocide in Rwanda that he and Hillary could have, that they allowed 500,000 Iraqi children to die from sanctions that we caused, yet not once did they feel any moral qualms about that. I could list you 500 things that each of these people who have been present have done, both Republican and Democrat, and yet their admirers, the Nation magazine editors, all these people, the supplicants, these people seem to adore the power that they emanate and do not deplore actively and separate from the actions that they undertake. Where is this resonance disconnecting?
Yeah, and that's a perfect example, though, of, like, in other words, like what I'm calling this psychological, like, this disease, actually it actually propagates itself through our, you know, through us being schizoid, through us being split in ourselves. That if we have a whole healthy psyche, we're not going to be supporting somebody who's committing genocide. But the fact that we do is an expression that inwardly we've become fragmented. We've become, you know, not connected to a part of ourselves. And then we become an instrument for, you know, this evil, or what I'm calling this psychological virus, to actually propagate itself, you know. And so the thing which is important that I point out in my book is that what's happening not only is the origin in the psyche, but it's this non-local phenomena, which is a physics term. And what that means is that it's not operating. If we see the evil as operating in somebody out there and we're not evil, and if we just see it out there, we're projecting the shadow, and then we've fallen under the spell of the very evil that we're reacting to. The whole point is that there's a deeper field that's informing what's playing out throughout the greater body politic, and we're a part of that. And we have to own our part. And, you know, but part of the pathology is that we become inwardly split in our own psyche, and that just feeds the illness.
I appreciate it. Paul, if do you believe that we should have laws that we all abide by, or should we have two sets of laws, rich, powerful, and politically connected, corporate laws, and then laws for everyone who has no political connections, power, or corporate protection?
Oh, well, I mean, it's clear that, I mean, it's supposedly the image that our country projects is that this is this country ruled by laws, not by men.
But that's a myth.
That's a total myth, right, exactly.
Well, what does it say about people who do not then challenge the people who are saying, you're rich and powerful, you gave me money, then I'm going to give a pass to British Petroleum and to HSBC and to UBS and Citigroup and Bank of America. You all get a pass, you get out of jail, but if you can't pay your traffic ticket, you go to jail. What does that say about the people? Not the people who don't vote, but the people who vote for the people who allow this to happen.
Yeah, and that's an example of that. We're completely complicit in what's playing out. And it's the whole point that there's something to understand the illness that's happening in our world that's actually taking us down as a species. You actually can't see it as a separate self, but you have to understand it as a field phenomena that we're all interconnected and interdependent and playing these roles, which is actually empowering the evil to play out. And, you know, to the extent that each one of us has to come to terms in our own heart with how we're playing that role, how we're unwittingly being an instrument of evil by whether collusion or supporting or by turning away, by actually, oh, I can't do anything, I feel not empowered, I'm not going to deal with it, I'm just going to turn my head and not look. That itself is the very stance that where we unwittingly become a conduit for the evil then, you know, to propagate itself.
Wasn't it Jean-Paul Sartre who said, when the rich wage war, it's the poor who die?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the rich who are on the front lines fighting these wars.
In anything, they are always protected, excluded, separated. And part of the art of becoming successful in our society as a celebrity, or with power, or with wealth, or with status or title, is that you separate yourself. So ours is a culture, not just a society, but a culture of separation. What does that tell us?
Yeah, well, that's an expression of our insanity, because when you really inquire into who we are, you discover that we're not separate, that we're interconnected and interdependent. And the fact that, like you just described, that our culture is this culture of being separate, that's an expression of our collective insanity. Because I think it's important to understand we're in the middle of a collective psychosis of titanic proportions. And part of the psychosis is that there's very few people even talking about it in these terms. It's become accepted what we do. People just, oh, yeah, that's normal that our government lies and is waging endless wars and all that. But I think it's really important, and that's what I try to point out in my book, that there's this psychic epidemic that's completely running rampant all throughout our, you know, the whole planet, through our species.
Two more quick questions. I'm going to need a little quick answer so we can end our program on time. Then we'll continue with a post-program internet discussion. I'm greatly concerned about the definition of mental illness that our psychiatric profession wishes to force us to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people have breakdowns that are then pathologized and treated in a way that I believe is biomolecularly barbaric, mm-hmm. using psychotropic drugs and the SSRIs and others.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to you speak about Wetiko, which is, mm-hmm. by the way, the dispelling Wetiko is the name of his book, Wetiko.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost go as far as to suggest that modern psychiatry is Wetiko incarnate.
I totally agree. I can't say enough about that. Yeah, because I was somebody who had so I was having a full-blown spiritual awakening in 1981, and I got thrown in mental hospitals for the first year and told, oh, you're going to be mentally ill for the rest of your life. And I was fortunate to be able to come out of that. So, like, the psychiatric system is totally, from my point of view, one of the main instruments of this virus that's playing out. And so many people who are having awakenings have actually been institutionalized and have their process just aborted. And it's tragic.
Okay, I appreciate that. Simple words, but profound implications you just shared with us. Paul, my last question for our regular program listeners. Today there is a positive psychology movement that has gone mainstream and is now even being adopted in employee training on a massive scale across corporate America. And the leaders of this movement have created it into a very lucrative industry. In some ways it has its origins in the I'm okay, you're okay drivel of the early New Age, the kind of a denial of dualism that wants to whitewash everything bad in order to focus only in light, harmony, and beauty, and to demonize anything that questions or challenges authority or entertains doubts or negativity. And this is now characteristic of most spiritual groups and movements today that have decided to retire the idea of evil for all eternity. Please speak about this denial of Wetiko, the shadow in popular spirituality, and why it is dangerous and an obstacle to the means and purpose for following a legitimately spiritual path.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, the way to become enlightened is to make the darkness conscious, is by adding light to the shadow, is by coming to terms with the evil in the world and in ourselves. And so many of these New Age spiritualities, they will look away. They're in avoidance of evil. Oh, they don't want to feed it and give it any energy. But in their looking away, they're unwittingly investing it with incredible power and energy. I mean, yeah, I just want one final thing. The town I live in, the big spiritual bookstore won't carry my Dispelling Wetiko book because, oh, it mentions the word evil. It's a perfect example of that.
You've been listening to my guest, Paul Levy. He is the author of Dispelling Wetiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil, North American Books, or North Atlantic Books. His website is awakenthedream.com.
Awaken in the dream, Gary.
AwakenintheDream.com. I want to thank all of the land-based stations for carrying us, and we look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now, Paul, we go to the final part of our program. And about a year ago, we had John Corsi as a guest, a systems theorist who specializes in X events, events that can unpredictably tip the scales of equilibrium and balance into a catastrophic condition. And he was asked, is it all of our distorted visualization, our weirdness, that is now manifesting as reality? And for many spiritual traditions, especially Buddhism, the weirdness all around us is a projection of our shared collective inner state. Can you relate this to our understanding of Wetiko?
Yeah, totally. Well, the thing about whether it's called Wetiko or whatever is that it's this dreamed up phenomena, which is to say, when you view our life as if it's a mass shared dream, then you discover, oh wow, what's actually happening in our world is the materialization of our dreaming, of our inner state of consciousness, you know, just projected out and actually dreamed up into materialization. And it's actually reflecting something, you know, deep inside of us. So the whole point is that if we can either have the recognition of what's being shown to us, and then we can actually, that's in the service of helping us to wake up, or if we don't see what's being shown to us, then we're compelled to enact in a self-destructive way, unconsciously, again and again, so that the manifestations, the evil manifestations of Wetiko, become more and more like just oppressive and blatant until we finally do wake up.
That's a good summary. My final question is, how do we protect ourselves from it in the personal sense, and then how do we struggle against this collective nature? For example, in journalism and reporting and broadcasting, what would be the best means of analyzing events that would also expose the events or the players, you pronounce it, of course, correctly.
I'm not even sure. I just pronounce it the way the air comes through my channels in my inner.
Oh, okay.
You know, so yeah, I'm not even sure what the right way is.
Wetiko. So it could be Wetiko or Wetiko.
Wetiko, whatever. Yeah.
How do you analyze this on a personal level?
Right. Well, the thing is that, you see, it's an inner disease of the soul that explicates itself through the medium of the outside world, which is to say that what's happening in the outer world is a actually expression of what's happening inside of us in a synchronistic way. So one thing, you know, one of the first things is to realize, wow, we all can fall prey to this. Any one of us at any moment can fall into our unconscious and unwittingly become an instrument for evil. And seeing that really cultivates this humbleness in ourselves. And that's one of the main inoculations against the bug. And then the whole second thing is that you discover encoded in the evil of Wetiko, it's actually helping us to wake up. And what that means is that it's snapping us out of this separate self where we imagine we're separate from other people, and we have the recognition of our true nature, which is that we're interconnected and interdependent with everyone, with all of life. And so that point of view really cultivates compassion. So the the combination of the compassion, and sometimes compassion can be incredibly fierce. It's not just like this smiley face idiot compassion, but it can really say no and set a boundary and connect with our power and speak our voice. Okay.
Paul, you shared some really profound insights, and I truly appreciate your position, and all the best on enlightening people.
I really appreciate that, Gary. Thank you so much.
Paul Levy, my guest. Talk back, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Also, I just want to let people know that Dr. Nadia, a PhD in psychology, number one in her class at Albert Einstein School of Medicine and Yeshiva University, she is back. You can visit her at the store, and she'd like to say hello to those that she was counseling to see how you're doing. So she's there, and you can go by at 89th and Broadway any day in the afternoon and say hello to her. So we're glad she's back and helping people. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I want to let you know that your listeners are most assuredly listening, and they are sending me some great feedback. Here's a question that keeps coming up, and I'm sure you'll be able to address this. One of the most important questions that keeps coming through is, why are there only two thoughts about how to manage our ailing economy? The Democrats want us to engage in massive spending. The Republicans want us to engage in massive austerity. And they are saying, is there not another approach that could work? That's some of the questions, the gist of the questions that are coming to me.
All right. Let us look at it from both perspectives. Neither is correct. If you start massive austerity programs, you're starting with a negative. People are suffering. If you look at the statistics, the average American has no savings. At least 70% of Americans have no savings. Over 56% of all American workers can only last for 3 months before they're completely destitute. And over 26% have zero savings, no cash at all. They literally live day to day. So let's just say that you take the Republican or the conservative perspective, corporate conservative, because true conservatism also ushers in compassion. That seems to have been forgotten by everyone from Reagan forward. Now, let's take away what a person already doesn't have, security. Let's take away their ability to make a living by having them work longer hours or multiple jobs at a lower wage so that those who control the source of the money get to keep more of it for themselves. An artificially inflated profit immediately corresponds in direct measure, duality, to what someone had to give back for them to make that profit. So if they can make an extra $100 million by cutting wages and benefits, then that gives them that $100 million. But where did it come from? It came from what others sacrificed. So they look better to their stockholders who are greedy and don't have ethical considerations of how the money is made, and to corporate America that is greedy. So where exactly is this supposed to end? Look at Greece. I predict that within the next 12 months, Greece will burn, meaning literally not the unionists. They have betrayed everyone. Not the politicians. They're all corrupt. Not the government. It is completely useless and in the pocket. They've been cockooed, and they're in the pocket of the European Union and the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank. It will be the young people who have absolutely nothing to lose. And was it not Gerald Salante who said, when you have nothing to lose, you lose it? They'll lose it. They'll burn down the country. And they will go after all these politicians and corporatists. And unfortunately, it'll be indiscriminate at that point. So it's just going to end up being, that's what I hope does not happen, but that's the only thing I can see. I can't see any other outcome. Actions once begun cannot be stopped. They can only be diverted. So there will be a cause and effect. I think that'll also happen in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and in Ireland. The United States is already preparing for it. There are these maneuvers all across cities from Miami Beach and other cities planning if there is any social unrest, how to stop it. And they're trying to desensitize the troops in their training, not to consider that that could be your neighbor. and your coworker or former student is just an angry American and they're in danger. With austerity, the bottom gets closer, and the impact of people who have nothing, they don't have food, they don't have shelter, they don't have job, they don't have gainful employment, they don't have the ability to support their lifestyle, there's going to be an outcome. But right now, it's amazing that only in America have we learned how to anesthetize the people to, in effect, not make them realize that we are creating pain in them and injury through austerity measures. So austerity does not work. Austerity will not rebalance an economy unless, and here is where they haven't focused, unless it's an austerity of the federal, state, and local governments in support of corporate America. Now, there is where we should have austerity. It should be corporate austerity. No more handouts, bailouts, no more gifts, no more tax breaks, nothing for corporate America. That would save you $2 trillion a year. Then bring everything down to what it is needed to function and protect people and service people. That's half of government would go away. If you're going to grow an economy, you have to grow it where it is most likely to be sustained and in fairness to the workers and the community they live in, that's small businesses. So grow an economy by supporting interest-free loans to small businesses, providing that they give a living wage with health benefits to their workers for each one hired. That way you can put 10, 15 million people to work at a living wage and blossom all economies. And lastly, have set up in every community in the United States a foundation that is given support by individuals for a 2-to-1 tax write-off or corporations 2-to-1 tax write-off, where every penny has to stay within the community, nothing from outside, no private contractors. That means you de-ghettoize America. You hire people within the community to de-ghettoize the community and then rebuild it for what the community needs from community input. You do those things, you've reversed all problems that we have currently in the United States. We're out of time. Thanks. Utrice Lead is on hold. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. Today we're talking about capital offenses. Treasury nominee Jack Lew is getting grilled. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta fires a few choice words as his parting shots. And Chuck Hagel's confirmation gets stalled. And we are going to do some fact-checking with Obama's State of the Union address.
We look forward to it. Utrice Lead, starting in a moment.